What's up, sinners and choosers? Welcome to Choose Your Own Religion. My name is Joe. Thank you guys for tuning in this week. My guest today is Noah Lampert, who I'm really stoked to have on. He runs a podcast network called the Mind Pod Network, which has some absolutely great podcasts on it. If you're a fan of this show, you're probably going to be a fan of something on that network because there's just so many great podcasts on it, and including his own called Synchronicity. And I love Noah for helping to try to bring these sort of spiritual ideas into more common discussions. And so we met at his Mind Wave event that he had, this live event he was putting on in LA, and agreed to come on the show, and we fucking made it happen. And I thought it was an awesome conversation, and I don't want to say too much more about it. So go to mindpodnetwork.com. He's got podcasts with the Tao of Comedy, It's All Happening with Zach Leary. Got a lot of great podcasts on there, getting into spiritual, metaphysical type discussions, including Tara Brach, who is one of the great mindfulness teachers of our time, in my opinion. So go to mindpodnetwork.com, check out all those great podcasts. And if you like this show, you can go to chooseyourownreligion.com, find old episodes there. I also have a blog on there that I keep up. It's called This Week in Spiritual Narcissism. And every week I go to a different church or some kind of spiritual community type experience and blog about it. But anyway, that's there if you want it at chooseyourownreligion.com. Also, if you're listening to this before May 11th, on May 11th in Baltimore, I'm going to be at the Charm City Comedy Festival on Thursday at 8:30 is when my slot is, and I would love to see any of you sinners and choosers that are in the Baltimore, D.C., Nova, SOPA, wherever areas. If you're within shouting distance, I would love to see you in Baltimore on Thursday, May 11th at 8:30 at the Charm City Comedy Festival. You can find more info if you Google Charm City Comedy Festival. And that's pretty much it. This is a great talk. Please welcome in Noah Lampert.
Allow the soothing music and uplifting affirmations to center your heart and mind in an awareness of God's love.
Wake up, my dear sinners. Wake up from your deep rest. Won't you say your prayers? Know that you are blessed. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I hope that you choose your own religion.
Thank you for coming on.
Of course.
I had a great time once again at the Mind Wave event.
I'm glad.
About a month ago. How did you feel about it?
I loved it. I didn't know what to expect because I had never been to LA before, so I was relying primarily on Yoshino and Justin Hopkins to, you know, logistically get everything together. Mm-hmm. So that was a little nerve-wracking because I think after the first week, we had like 14 ticket sales and we're like, oh shit, no one's going to come to this thing. And like, I couldn't tap into my networks because, like, you know, I have people who live in LA, but it's probably like 20 people, not that many. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say nervous, but we were anxious about the turnout. And then obviously, like, it didn't matter. Like, it was the right amount of people. I thought the talks were excellent. More important than the amount of people, the type of people who came. Like, I remember remarking, at the end of the day, I had inadvertently, after Michael Donovan gave me the largest microdose of mushrooms ever, it was not a microdose, you know, I had left my wallet and computer right at the entrance to the event, like, the entire day, and, like, it didn't even occur to me that someone would take it or do anything, and of course no one did. It was just, like, a great group of people getting together, and it was very encouraging, and then speaking with all of the speakers after and during, like, everyone was ecstatic and can't wait to do another one. So we're trying to put another one of those together. Definitely a couple more this year. We're going to do a New York one. I'm in discussions now to see what spaces we can use. But yeah, I mean, we're hoping that can be more of a focal point of the network and, you know, just getting people together.
Yeah, that's awesome. And yeah, I totally agree with you, like the type of people there, because I've been to live podcasts before, and it's a cool thing with like, I worked the LA Podcast Festival this past year, and there was one, I remember, I want to say it was Welcome to Night Vale, which is like a fictional podcast that I had never really heard of. Apparently it's a huge, like it's like a huge following, yeah. And like a ton of people showed up to it, and they're all like wearing their fan gear, and they're like, they have this like all these sort of like insider jokes and language type of thing. And it's really weird observing that as an outsider to that thing, but also cool how the internet and how podcasting has created these tribes out of like, you know, nothing.
And, it's totally true. I mean, the tribal aspect, I read a great book a couple years ago called Tribal Leadership. And it was like a pretty routine, you know, business executive level management style book. But the principles that they were, I picked it up because I had read Phil Jackson's 11 Rings book, which is oh my God, it's such a good book. And like, I didn't know what to expect because, you know, he's so mainstream. And Phil, you know, Phil Jackson follows MindPod Network on Twitter. He follows like 70 people. And it's like, yeah, it's like the coolest thing. But he had recommended this tribal leadership book, and you realize how people who record and do their own podcasts kind of they have all of the qualities that a tribal leader would have, and they're interested in connecting with other people, connecting people for no ulterior motives, you know, talking about things, providing value for people, making sure people thrive and do well. So when you take those qualities and then, you know, take a bunch of people like that and put them together on a network, it's been like one of the most fulfilling things I've done in my life, because but a lot of professional endeavors that I've done, even if they're successful, quote unquote, are kind of like a pain in the ass to put together and do and work with people. And there's different ideologies and there's different strategies and there's all these things. But I got to tell you, this event, it was like the easiest thing I've ever been a part of. I mean, it was work, you know, wrangling people kind of, but like everyone was just down and like there was no like, you know, ulterior motives or anything. It was just fucking great. So I love that podcasts enable this, you know, so quickly.
Yeah, totally. And I think that feeling, when I've had that feeling, and I had it recently, I put on a live version of this podcast last week. Cool. Well, it wasn't even really a live version of this podcast. It's kind of a fucked up worship service that like had like stand-ups doing quote unquote sermons and like improvised cool. hymns and shit. It was awesome. And the turnout for me wasn't exactly, you know, my ego, you're always like, oh, I want like 100 people there. You know, you always want just some number that's not even realistic, especially in LA. Just trying to get people out anytime in LA is just,
yeah, that's what I hear,
brutal. But at the same time, when you believe in whatever kind of I don't know, mission or whatever you're doing, then to some extent it doesn't really matter how many people are there, and you're just like, I'm just gonna make this a great time for everybody that's here. And
it doesn't matter, but it does. Like, I'm someone who, like, as much as I was listening to a really interesting podcast between Yoshino from Artist Decoded and Michael Phillip from Third Eye Drops. And he just had Yoshino on, Michael did. And the whole conversation was revolving around taking a leap of faith. And this was, centered around professional leaps of faith. So, you know, trying to get all your ducks in a row and make sure you have enough money so you can leave your job, so you can pursue your passions. And what eventually emerged from the conversation, and this is my experience completely, is that you can't really like hedge against what you're going to do. And how this relates to enough people is, like, for as much as I like to, you know, be the hallmark for not getting too caught up in the egoic types of things, I certainly want enough people to come to my event. I certainly don't want to look like a doof. But what you're saying is ultimately the most important thing. And that's why, less than the numbers, even though I was obsessing about them before the event, the quality of the event and the quality of the people who were there, it supersedes all of the other stuff. It doesn't, if there was five people there and they were super engaged. I mean, I know this is from like digital marketing, you know, like if you have an email list of like 60,000 people and they're not really engaged, it doesn't matter that you have an email list of 60,000 people. If I have my email list of 900 people, but they're super fucking engaged, that's more valuable. And these vanity metrics and all these things, they help us feel better about ourselves, but they're not actually accomplishing anything. I mean, unless we're talking about like revenue coming in from like ticket sales, but that was never going to be the goal with the initial Mindwave event. And, you know this from doing a podcast too, like you have to be a special type of person to go headfirst into a medium that essentially has no monetization strategy, right. No path to even what success would look like. I look at Dustin Marshall from Feral Audio. He now I think has the third biggest podcast network in the world, and he's still fucking going insane. You know, he's killing himself to try to make this shit work, which is slightly scary for people with other podcast networks and podcasts, but I think it speaks to, you know, the idea or the willingness of people to want to make this work for various reasons. It's not financially based. I don't know if this is true, but I think it is. If you hold that intention and aspiration long enough, eventually shit pans out. And it may not pan out and we're all millionaires or all super successful, but I do think that's like the main factor for having something be successful in whatever permutation that is.
Is that that devotion sort of?
Yeah, I mean, it's the belief, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like what the Quakers would probably call the still small voice within. It's yeah. Your conscience. It's your little thing that even if you, it's the thing that even if you're in a job where you're making a lot of money and, you know, you're able to take care of all your obligations. I'm speaking from personal experience here. Mm-hmm. It's that thing inside of you that's like, now you want to be doing something else. You should be doing something else. You should be doing this thing. And like, if you just can't get rid of it, then eventually it's wise to pay attention to it, because I think too many people have that voice, hear that calling, and they do what Joseph Campbell says the worst thing you can do, which is ignore it and bury it. And that, I think, leads to a tremendous amount of internal conflict and frustration for people that they're not even aware is going on, because they maybe wanted to be, you know, a musician or a writer or a comedian when they were like 15, 16, and now they're 40. And they're in some job that they know they hate, and they have this viewpoint of what the world is. And it's just like, you know, yeah, the world is not exactly what you thought it is, but you're also not following your bliss, as Joseph Campbell would say. And yeah, I think it's also scary to follow your passion. It's like everyone makes it sound like, yeah, just follow your bliss. Doors will open where they weren't before. Yeah, but it's fucking terrifying. Like,
oh, yeah.
I've not met one person who has taken that leap who's like, yeah, it was super fucking easy. I didn't have to worry about anything. I had no concerns. It just happened and everything was great. Like, I haven't heard that story yet.
Right, because it wouldn't be a leap of faith if you weren't leaping into some unknown thing without some kind of, ultimately there's some net you're leaving into this whole blank space. Yeah, and that the idea of the little small voice, I mean, I think that's what the people would describe as, or people in years past would describe as the Holy Spirit, even. Like,
right.
That's like how they interpreted, quote unquote, God talking to them. You know, maybe they had this idea of like, oh, it's a person talking to me and then making me think this thought or something, like a kind of bicameral mind thing from Westworld or whatever.
Yeah. Your operating system running in the background that you're not aware of. I mean, I wonder what that voice is or what we're tuning into. To me, I think I'm just running with this off the top of my head, but
yeah.
I think, you know, the brain, the analogy of a brain as kind of a radio that can be tuned to different frequencies, I think is pretty apt here. And I think when you really do, I mean, Carl Jung had one of the most interesting experiences with voices in his head, and he was a preeminent psychologist and one of the world's greatest thinkers while he was alive. Meanwhile, as he had his burgeoning and successful psychology practice and, you know, seeing tons of students and clients, you know, he's writing the Red Book, which is essentially him talking to this, we can call it imaginary or real, but this voice in his head that he called Philemon, which is this godhead archetype paternal figure. And he's basically losing his fucking mind. Like, he's
yeah.
writing down and talking to this voice in his head, and he's actually saying, making commentary on the side, like, I think I'm going insane. Like, I don't know what the fuck this is. And I think whether we want to describe it as the Holy Spirit or some other entity or ourselves or our soul or some frequency, you know, that's to be figured out through your particular lens of what you identify with. What's important to me is that A, that exists, B, however route you go there to get the message of what's going on, that you hone that ability, your intuition, whatever you want to call it. And then B, just don't ignore it. That's the thing. Like, yeah. The more you ignore, I mean, I remember the first time I remember hearing this still small voice, whatever, practically applied in my life was when I was lying, when I was like, you know, a teenager or a kid. Like, and you hear the voice in your head, like, don't lie. It's not good to lie. You're lying now, but you still lie and blah, blah. And you're just ignoring it. And then if you trace back everything that happens when you ignore that voice, good shit usually does not happen.
Yeah.
Typically, it's not like, oh, I ignored that and everything is wonderful.
Yeah. And often I find, and, you know, sometimes it's like the same thing we're talking about is also your gut instinct a lot of times. And it's like, I can't remember if this was a Stoic thing I came across recently, where I came across this, but somebody had this phrase where it's, don't just trust your instinct, but obey it. Right. And so it's like, it's that same deal where you hear that small voice and it's not just like, it's just trusting that that is going to lead you somewhere good. And I find a lot of times what's so difficult about it is that it's, I find my small voice often flies in the face of what's going to give me a short-term gain, but it will often have a long-term reward if I can trust, again, it's that leap of faith to be like, being honest in this moment is going to be ultimately the great thing, you know?
Yeah, it's just, it's not like a hop of faith, you know, it's not like a little like small little step of faith, right. It's a leap, like you're jumping off something. And you know, I often wonder, I think about how we kind of shape our own reality, which I believe we do, and I wonder if there is a stigma attached to something like a leap of faith, where it has to be this difficult chasm we need to jump over, or if it's just a story that has been kind of permeating our culture that we identify with, or a story that we're telling ourselves, either maybe even unconsciously, that we are playing out. Because I've noticed that happens a lot, at least in my life, and I know other people's too, where like you have these operating systems or belief sets in your mind that you're not really fully aware of, and this same scenario just keeps playing out in life. And what Jung and Marie-Louise von Franz would call this is just projections. You're projecting either your shadow, your archetype, your anima if you're a guy, your animus if you're a girl, or woman. And, you know, those projections, you're typically not even aware that you're putting them on someone else, and it's some internal mechanism. The reason I pose that question is I do think there is some aspect of surrender, which is what we're talking about with this leap of faith, whether it's surrendering to the small voice in your head or to some circumstances or whatever, it does seem like you're not going to get that perfect A-B choice where it's going to be like A is the route to go where you're going to be happy and it's going to be easy and it's going to be great, and B is the wrong thing to do and, you know, it's easy not to do that. It's, we have to kind of summon up the willpower to make difficult decisions and know that things may not work out exactly like we want them to, but by making that decision, we at least put the wheels in motion to find out. And that's really what I think it is.
And that surrender is so key, because like, I think, and this definitely was, I've been reading, I have been reading a daily stoicism thing where it's like, you know, like a one stoic thought a day and then kind of meditation on it by Ryan Holiday. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
No.
He has some great stuff like Ego is the Enemy, a lot of great stuff on stoicism and whatnot. Anyway.
Oh, cool.
There's one thing that I read a couple weeks ago about surrendering. Part of it is like we all have this plan. We all stress out when things aren't going according to plan. Obviously, that's like a that's like a constant theme in a lot of our lives. But a lot of times, if we surrender our idea of what our plan needs to be, we'll find there's a greater. This sounds fucking biblical or whatever. Like a greater plan, or like there's a guy with a plan for us. But like there's often something way cooler. I mean, I think about my own life. When I moved out to LA just purely to do stand up, and that was it. That was when I first came here like five, whatever years ago. I was like, that was my only goal, was to just get good at stand up. I didn't want to do anything else. And it wasn't until I started opening myself up to, like, I kept running into brick walls on that route and being like, well, let me try this other thing. And now I'm podcast. I would never have even thought of doing the podcast.
Tell me about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Any of that shit. So. You're totally that surrender. I'm curious, what was your life like before you started MindPod?
My life has always been a little bit other, I guess you would call it. My friends from the Bronx would call it other. you know, it basically, from a really early age, I had the idea or the conception that I wasn't really perceiving the world like other people. And it was shaped by because I would ask questions about things I had experienced from like a really young age, like 6, 7, that no one really had like answers for. And it wasn't like they weren't understanding what I was saying, but like I had this experience when I was like 7 or 8, where I remember going out into my backyard and being able to perceive it in multiple different ways. It felt like the closest analogy I could give is like if you take psychedelics and then you go look at a familiar place and it just feels like a completely different place. But I obviously was 6, 7. I'm not taking psychedelics. But I remember not only being aware that there was a different way to perceive what was going on, but that I could shift that perception at will. So I could be like, wow, this feels like the back of my yard in the summertime, and this feels like it in the wintertime, and this feels it like when it's scary, and this feels like when it's not. And I was like, I remember just talking to as many people as I could about that throughout my life, and people were like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, really, like, what? That doesn't make any sense to me, blah, blah, blah. And I also remember having thoughts like on the school bus when I was a kid, like, what happens to all these people when I get off the bus? And imagining like the bus continuing to go and dropping these kids off at their home and then them talking to their parents and realizing that everyone has a completely different experience in the world, yet we still function, you know, as though everything is normal and this is how it works. So I was really young when I was thinking about that. You know, everything is pretty normal. And then I did try LSD. I went to Berklee College of Music summer program when I was 15 years old, and someone brought some LSD from San Francisco, and that my first psychedelic trip. And I had always been interested in LSD. At that point, I was 15. I was probably smoking marijuana pretty infrequently, maybe, you know, once a week or a couple times a month, a few times a month. So I wasn't really doing any drugs, really doing anything mind altering chemically or substance wise. So I took LSD. I'd read about it. I'd read so many books about it. Thought I knew kind of what it was about. Obviously had no idea until I did it. It was like an 18-hour trip. And that still I hold up as such a big transitional pivot point in my life, because I was just like, I describe it like I was walking around the world with my head up my ass. And then like I finally realized that there was a way not to have your head up your ass. Like I just don't even know what my operating system was. The reason I remember it still to this day is I realize a lot of people who haven't had an experience that kind of jars them out of their regular consciousness are still walking around like that. Like, this is how the world works. And that to me is a, you know, a scary thing, because this rigidity that can happen when you think you have things figured out, or you think you know the way the world is, which is essentially what we're taught to do in school. We're learning the ways of the world. Right. And this is how it works. And now you operate. So that shit never jived with me after that. I had always known, even in middle school before I tried psychedelics, that this shit was just like a game. You know, you go to elementary school, you get good grades, to get good grades in middle school, to get good grades in high school, to go to a good college. And like, you know, by the time I was in high school, I was just like, this shit is a ruse. Like, I don't think any of my teachers have anything figured out. I don't think anyone who I've spoken to really gets what's going on. I don't even believe in this thing called an adult. I realize that people are still going through the same shit that I'm going through as a teenager when they're in their 40s and 50s and 60s. So I don't believe that. So I started taking school a little bit less seriously in high school. And then I decided to go to Northeastern. I applied for like a 2-week application on psychology because that seemed interesting to me. Went to Northeastern in Boston, hated it, withdrew after a year, applied to Berklee College of Music, where I'd gone for that 5-week program, got in there, had an amazing time at Berklee. I was in Boston for like 7 or 8 years. You know, and you have to be kind of crazy to go to a music school. I mean, it's like probably one of the silliest decisions you could make. And I'm lucky that like my mom paid for my college education almost in full. So I didn't leave with debt, but like to go to a music school to be like, I'm going to make a career as a musician or something. It's like it's ridiculous. Like, you know, you're limiting quite a bit of options, but I loved it. I learned a lot of stuff. I met a lot of people. Then I moved to New York in 2008, and, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing. Like, I knew that there was only so many places I could move with a music degree and actually find work. I was working there for a while, odd jobs, like a production assistant, helping some record labels and things like that. And then what was a really big turning point in my life, and this leads up to the MindPod Network stuff, is in 2012, a friend of mine, one of my best friends, recommended I listen to a podcast called Duncan Trussell Family Hour. And I was like, I'll check it out. And I happened to listen to Raghu Marcus on the first episode. And I was like, oh, this is cool. I liked it. I didn't love it. I'll cop to that. I liked it, but I had just, weirdly enough, watched a documentary called Fierce Grace about Ram Dass. And he had had this stroke, and just it really, really moved me to the point where I was essentially in tears. Not essentially, I was in tears at the end of it, and I didn't know why. It was just like this weird, visceral connection. So then the next day, my friend says, listen to this podcast. It's Raghu. He works for Ram Dass. Started investigating. I had known about Richard Alpert and Timothy Leary because I was interested in psychedelics. Didn't really know who Ram Dass was. The spiritual component of that stuff didn't not resonate with me. I had always been interested in reading books and philosophies and Indian stuff in particular, but it didn't appeal to me before then. So I started working with Love Server Member, doing some digital strategy with them, kind of revamping their website, their social media. And, you know, I did it for free for like 8 months. It developed into a pretty strong relationship that led to me getting hired as a freelance consultant for the next, you know, currently I'm still doing it. So 5 years, that blossomed into a ton of different relationships, you know, with a lot of Buddhist teachers and people around the country and the world, like Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, you know, Krishna Das, all of these people who I got to meet and just kind of understand this way of being and just this other world that I didn't know existed. So then in 2014, there was these Ram Dass retreats in Maui, which were fucking awesome. And they were really cool. Really, Maui is just like a very magical place. Like if you've ever been to like some holy spot where it's imbued with like, you know, vibes, like Maui is definitely one of those spots for sure. So went there, made sure, I'm a avid marijuana smoker, made sure before I got there that there was some good weed waiting for me, and it was really good weed, really, 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 really good weed. We smoked in the parking lot every night before kirtan. Krishna Das would do this kirtan, which I was actually, my first retreat, I was very worried about because it's like, what is this religious devotional chanting? I don't know, you know, that's weird. But it's just music and it's fucking awesome. But we smoked outside one night. It was me and Duncan and a couple of other people. And basically he was like, you guys should start a podcast network. And I'm like, I don't know about that, man. Like that shit seems like a lot of work. I also knew that by starting a podcast network, it would be me pretty much starting the podcast network. Yeah. Even if I had partners and stuff, it was primarily going to be me. So we did. And the original one was all the teachers I mentioned. That has since evolved into Be Here Now Network, which I am not a part of. As a lot of things in life happen, things do not always go according to plan.
Right.
MindPod Network, I started it with three other people. It eventually became just me for a variety of reasons, which I don't have to go into all of those now, but I will one day. So it changed quite a bit. We went from having these teachers who had been steeped in various traditions for decades, really kind of a top-down level of wisdom, shifting to, I didn't want to shut down MindPod Network. I fought pretty hard to make sure I retained some aspect of what was there. And I started bringing on other people. I had met a lot of people over the previous years who I felt, while they weren't spiritual teachers per se, they were offering their own direct experience and insights and troubles and obstacles, but from various different perspectives. So to me, that made a lot of sense because I have always been interested in the people who are bridge makers, people who can connect two different areas, but bring them together in a way that makes sense and isn't forced. So to me, and it's amazing how many people I've connected with just in the past like year who feel the same way. To me, anyone who can normalize quote unquote spiritual concepts or things that are actually important that we don't really talk about regularly, that's an incredibly important thing to do, because I don't want, when someone hears us talking about you know, samsara, the world is an illusion, or Maya, or things like that, to be like, what the fuck is that? I don't care.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
If we can be talking about how your dreams and your experiences and your inner world actually affects external reality in more than just like, you know, I'm thinking of picking up this cup and I pick it up, but you're actually changing reality outside by doing inner work. Whatever paths and routes we can have to discuss those things, whether it's comedian, whether it's an artist, whether it's a musician, whether whatever it is, that to me is valuable, especially now, because we don't even have to discuss it. We take it as a fact now that we are being inundated with information. Most of the stuff we see online, unless it's coming from our friends, is trying to sell us something, whether it's an actual physical product or a service or just a viewpoint or perspective of the world, which is fine. I mean, everyone can go into the marketplace and pitch their idea of what reality is. The problem, as I see it, is a lot of this stuff, the intentions and the motives behind it are often not even known. It's just kind of like this momentum that has been building for decades based on the system we've made up. And I thought it would be a good idea if we could start injecting conversations like these, conversations, you know, about shit that actually matters and we deal with, not as like some grand, we're going to change the fucking world thing. Obviously, that would be great, but just as somewhat of an antidote to the constant barrage of transient, superficial, superfluous information that is hitting our screens and ears and everything all day. So yeah, I mean, that was a long answer to your question. What was I doing before MyPod Network? Really, I mean, I just want to put shit out in the world, whether it's art, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a conversation, whatever it is, that is going to have some positive impact on someone's life. And it's not to say you have to join some system or cult or whatever, but something that's going to pique your interest and be like, oh, there's another dimension. There's another layer here. Harkening back to what you were saying about when you pay attention to that small, still voice, like a whole world of possibility can open up. And that's really where we live moment to moment, every second of our day. It's just hard to be able to access this when you're worrying about God knows what. And when I say that, I don't say like, oh, I've done that. I've ascended to that level. I worry about, like, we're talking about taking leaps of faith. I took a leap of faith a year and a half ago to basically switch my business. Half I took the leap of faith, half I was pushed off the cliff. But, you know, I made the decision that I want to start doing products now. I don't want to have a client-based business for various reasons. I don't want to work with the people I've been working with. And this has been super uncomfortable. It's not like it was just like, boom, up, done, got it. Everything is great now. Like, I've been going through as much financial turmoil as I've gone through, you know, my entire adult life. I just bought a house. I have a kid. But I will tell you the interesting thing. This is very interesting for me because I always had the worst case scenarios in my head. You know, when you're not making money and freelance, you know, when you're freelance, that can happen at any time. So you have to be thinking about it. And I just imagine the worst case scenarios every single time. And I'll tell you, even though I have way less money than I do now, even though I am not regularly, but often freaking out about how I'm going to pay bills and all that, I am so much fucking happier. Like, so much fucking happier. I was making $150,000 2 years ago. No financial worries whatsoever. I could do whatever I wanted. But I was fucking miserable. I was burnt out. I was working, you know, 80-hour weeks, doing shit I didn't really want to be doing. nothing is worth that in my estimation. And shit always, if you're resourceful and you have a goal or an idea or a passion and you just keep working on it, shit will work out. That doesn't mean it's going to work out the way you want it to, but it will work out. So what you were saying about dropping your expectations is also incredibly important, because the less expectations you have for any particular thing, and you can have an idea of what you want it to be, but the less tied you are to those expectations, the happier you're going to be regardless of the result.
Yeah. Well, that was, man, there was so much, that was a fascinating journey you've been on. no, there's so much, there were so many points where I wanted, there's like so many in my head, you're just picturing all these little branches that come off like, oh, I could branch on this thing. I could branch on that thing. But that was, thank you for that answer. That was, was great. I mean, and something even, just even taking it back to like that 6 year old you seeing it in the backyard of, just these different things. I mean, to somebody who has done psychedelics, I'm like, oh yeah, I get it. I fucking get it.
Yeah. Well, we could, psychedelics were the first thing I could find that like gave people some idea of what I was talking about. But, you know, when you're on psychedelics, your whole consciousness is colored and imbued with that mm-hmm. experience. When you're just sitting there as like a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old and you're shifting. And the weird thing is I can yeah. still do it to this day. I can go back to my childhood home and still shift those perspectives. Mm. And it's like a weird thing to do. It's just, it changes reality even though you're not actually changing it, which is a
yeah.
interesting phenomenon.
Well, that's what I think. I mean, that's the first time weed gave me a little bit of this when I first, yeah. whenever I was first started smoking. And I was like, now you talk about somebody who was very much a rules follower, and maybe I was like kind of aware that life could be a game, but I was so bought into and invested in the game through all the way through middle school and high school, is like just very, very serious about a lot of it. I think psychedelics are one of the first times when it takes these like spiritual concepts, or it takes this idea that we are all from the same consciousness, that we are all having, we all have fungible, is it fungible the word I'm thinking of? Experiences. We all have, reality is very malleable.
Yes.
And psychedelics are something that take that sort of abstract concept and make it a visceral feeling,
you know,
and be like, oh, I feel that. I understand that in an intuitive way that it was impossible for me to understand before.
Direct experience, right? Which
is
completely different than a conceptual, which is why when I was saying, when I was reading books about LSD and any psychedelic, there's a difference between reading a book about going to a tropical island and how beautiful it is and then actually going to the place.
Right.
And no amount of reading is going to give you anything close to the actual experience.
Right. Studying the map versus actually, you know.
Exactly. Exactly.
Traveling
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And I'm curious too, throughout all this, did you have any background with religion specifically? Like, did your parents raise you as anything or try to raise you as anything?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up Jewish. I had a bar mitzvah. I even got confirmed in Judaism, which you go through 10th grade. Mm-hmm. You know, the truth is, the reason I did that is there were girls in my class. I mean, you know, not the purest of intentions. That said, I have always had, I wouldn't have called them mystical or transcendent experiences before I had done psychedelics, but I've always had that aspect permeate my life, as I think most people do. They might just not be aware of it or tuning into it. So there was that aspect, this mystical kind of coloring to my life. I have all, for whatever reasons, my dad had an extensive library, you know, in our house. And my parents got divorced when I was 5, but the library remained where I was living. And I would just go down there and pick books and read. And I remember you know, reading things like Jung and William James and the Variety of Religious Experience, and just being like totally drawn to it at a point where like no one I knew, like this is before the internet, right? We're talking like probably like early to mid 90s. So the internet was just coming in, but you know, there wasn't a ton of crossover and peers that I could speak to. So I would dive really deep. I also was a big science fiction fan. And I think a lot of people who read science fiction at an early age, like, you know, there's a lot of religious concepts and overtones to that, even if you're not explicitly delving into them.
Especially like Orson Scott Card with like Mormonism or whatever.
Yeah, there's so much stuff there that, I mean, ultimately what I believe is that, you know, religion or spirit or whatever you want to call it, it's everything. And this is like a weird concept, like, you know, you look at your cup of coffee, you're like, that's not God, that's not sacred, but the sacred isn't in the mundane. So when you kind of tune into that, that becomes your religion, so to speak. And then you can kind of look at like the organized religions, which I am not nearly as down on as a lot of people I speak to. I mean, it's hard to overlook the massive injustices and, you know, just horrors that have come out of organized religion. That said, I think most of them were formed with noble intentions. You know, maybe 50 years after Christ died, you know, people started really fucking it up and adding in their own stuff, and Christ would have been appalled at what was going on. But you know, I do think there are noble intentions. The problem is, and I don't think this is human nature, FYI. I think this is a cultural story that has been kind of integrated into people's lives. People like power. People like control. It gives them a sense of they're in charge of their own lives in the sense that they're consciously creating what's going on around them, when the truth is none of us are. None of us have the power to stop death. None of us have the power to stop sickness. None of us have the power to stop growing old. Maybe we will with Android stuff in the future. Who the fuck knows? But now we don't. And, you know, if you don't if you don't think about those things or contemplate that, you're probably going to be either completely ignoring them or fighting it every step of your life. And that's when you want to accumulate things that are related to power, like money, you know, resources, land, you know, emotional power, fame, celebrity, these things, because they it's trying to fill this hole in ourselves where we don't feel like we're enough. And part of that is the quest and the kind of impetus to discover what the fuck is going on. But another part of it is the cultural conditioning that's going on in our world. And for as much as I even talk about cultural conditioning, we can never escape that. We can't just unplug from our culture. We might like to, but even railing against culture, you're still engaging with it. So
yeah. It's kind of like one thing I really love that Ram Dass talks about every now and then is at least in some of his older talks is honoring your own incarnation. And in some ways I feel like you can't help you want to fight, especially somebody who's gone through various, you know, countercultural phases in his own life, or you know, as sometimes it's as simple as being a deadhead or whatever. But like, you know, you want to fight against your current, you know, the idea that like, oh, I'm a straight white male, you know, in this day and age, or you know, I'm part of all these various systems, I'm an American, you know, sometimes you don't like hate that idea, you're like you're somehow involved in the political scene or something. But ultimately, yeah, that's if you work through your culture, you can work through it instead of always, because you can't help but be a part of it. I can't control what my incarnation was.
Yeah. And I look at it like this. I take the tantric, you know, route. Listen, we all have the option to move to the Himalayas, pick a lineage, go meditate in a cave for the benefit of all sentient beings for the rest of our natural life. That's an option. However, if we were born in this country, if we were born in the Western world, depending on why you think we incarnate or who chooses where we incarnate, I ultimately believe it's us individually. We choose that. We have some say or some karmic impetus there. You know, take advantage of that. Do the things, go into the world to discover what's going on. There's not two separate things. There's not you being spiritual and you having your regular daily existence. They're the same fucking thing. So try to find the crossover and where you can begin to pierce the veil and see how this stuff is actually connected. That to me is incredibly important to do. And again, Carl Jung spoke about this in depth when he was traveling the world, going to Africa and India. And a conclusion he came to, which I think is very astute and poignant, is you can't escape your particular mentality and where you grew up. You will always this is weird for people to understand, and I haven't been to these countries, but I know people have, and I know people from these countries. Someone from India does not think about the world the same way that you and I do. And it's not because they're like, you know, different humans or anything. It's just their culture has thousands of years of a certain mindset that is imbued into, whether it's epigenetics, whether it's oral history, whether it's culture, whether whatever it is, karma. They're not thinking about the world in the same way. What's encouraging is I'm seeing these philosophies and ideas of non-linearity, because we're very linear and logical in the Western world. All the Abrahamic religions follow this, you know, very, even if it's mystical, somewhat empirical linear trajectory.
We like having 50 popes, you know, all in a row.
Right. And it's interesting. I mean, and you can see another way of doing that is like Tibetan Buddhism. They have a lineage. They have a lineage that is very rigorous and very well vetted throughout, you know, the annals of their history. You know, there's reincarnation involved with that and tulkus. But what I'm saying is when I see a movie like Arrival, this is something that I think is very important for the consciousness of Westerners, because what that movie did, and one of the reasons I love it so much, is it introduced this concept of nonlinear time, which is actually how time works. And I don't mean that in some like mystical, esoteric, woo-woo way. I mean, go study quantum physics, go study Albert Einstein's theory of relativity, and you'll understand time is not linear. It doesn't work. It flows backwards. It flows forward. It goes in a circle. And then if you go and compare that to mystical traditions, every single saint and mystic will back that up 1,000 times over. And you'll even hear it in like a simple statement like, be here now. Now is the only moment, which of course, yes, we know that now is the only moment. But how many of us that does that prevent from thinking about past memories or future events or what's going on, or we have to take our car in or whatever else? So there is this ability to recognize. Here's what I was going to say when you were talking. The key to me is being able to hold simultaneous two truths that seem to contradict each other. One is that we are a person. I'm a Noah. You're a Joe. This is who we are. This is where we grew up. This is our history. You know, we live in the world. There's good and bad. There's sweet and sour. There's these polarities. The other is that Noah and Joe and anyone listening, you don't actually exist. It is a constant state of flux where you are creating and weaving this story of who you are. But if you really start to break it down, this happens on psychedelics, this happens with meditation, you realize that shit isn't a solid entity. It doesn't actually exist. There seems to be something solid there, but it's certainly not our body. It's certainly not this idea of I, who we think we are. So how do we hold those two concepts together at the same time and go through our lives? Because when we can do that, we start to get, you know, more access to decisions, to perspectives. You don't get fixated. I mean, the source of most of my troubles in life are when I identify or get fixated on a concept of something, you know, whether I get angry when someone drives like this, or I wanted this to happen, or I don't have this, you know, those are the things. So I'm very much identifying and attaching to some concept, which isn't real, some concept of what I need or what I want or how I am. That starts to bring in a lot of problems. And what's going on there, this is why the ego gets a bad rap all the time. And I think the ego, for as bad of a rap as it gets, actually has a function in our life. It's not like some mistake like, oh, we got born with these stupid fucking egos, got to just drop them and then everything will be okay. Like, this is how we navigate the world. If we didn't have egos, we'd be bumping into walls all the time. We'd be eating, you know, poison. We'd be having no idea what's going on. We'd be letting vicious murderers and animals into our vicinity to kill us. So there is a function of the ego. The problem is we've let it basically take over every aspect of our consciousness. And when that happens, things start to go wonky. And then we start building cultural institutions, paradigms, systems that really don't honor what's actually going on, which is this two mindset to hold these two things together. And we've just built an entire world based on this egoic kind of aspiration and clinging. And that, you know, that pretty much sums up how you get Donald Trump as president, sums up how you get a lot of things in the world, corporations running amok, because we've just completely lost contact that there's some other dimension to what's going on in our day-to-day experience.
Yes, all that reminds me of something I've heard, I think David Nickturn talk about with Buddhism, is you know, these two, you have relative truth and absolute truth, and relative truth being these, the things that we talk about. These relative truth is like, there is I have a job later today. I have, you know, there's a difference between liberals and conservatives. There's a difference between, you know, these things that are necessary to navigate and function in the world and to make any kind of sense of it, to communicate about it to anybody. And also the idea of the ego as being a version of that relative truth too. And I totally agree with what you're saying, is that the ego is necessary. And we can, I think what can be really cool about some religion is if you can be alchemical with your ego and like and trick it a little bit, you can sort of get people to work together on the same page. And sometimes you have to give the ego little candy and little treats. An analogy I've liked to think about it is like using your ego as like dogs on a sled, on like one of those Alaskan like sled mushes. Like
you, Iditarod, yeah.
Right. So like you need the dogs to run in order for your sled to get anywhere. But you also don't let the dogs pick where to go. You're ultimately saying, I'm going to use this a grander absolute truth that I understand, that there is there's something greater than the bullshit of the relative truth, but also I need that. I need my dogs. I need my ego to help get me anywhere at all.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing where a function where the ego can become very useful is the same way you look at pain or suffering. most of us would easily say we don't want any pain. We don't want another suffering. So why do we have it? Is it because the universe is a cruel place? Is it because of past action alone and just karma? I don't think so. I think those are elements of what's going on. I don't think the world's a cruel and shitty place, actually. But it's an opportunity. Pain and suffering are to wake us up. They suck you into the moment. When you have a pain in your arm or a headache or something, you're in the fucking moment. I mean, you may be creating all this other suffering around it, but you're in the fucking moment. And when you're in the moment, when you're going through difficult experiences, whether it's brought about by the ego, it's an opportunity to pause and be like, what the fuck is going on? Why is this happening? What caused this to happen? What are the conditions? You know, how did I get there? And so when your ego, this happens to me all the time because I work with a lot of really, really smart and talented people who are building networks online, who are building communities. And once in a while, my ego will flare up and I will get either envious or competitive. And instead of just running with it and being like, oh, I gotta do better than Michael Phillip from Third Eye Drops. I gotta do better from Corey. I gotta get better with my posts and stuff. I'll just be like, listen, there's my ego. There it's popping up. I'm now aware that it's happening and I'm gonna choose not to engage the way it wants me to engage and instead be more egalitarian about this. Now, some of the pitfalls that can emerge from there is like you have to make sure that if you're taking that, you know, tact, that you're surrounding yourself with good people. The reason I can constantly use my ego as kind of an opportunity to be like, relax a little bit is the people I mentioned, Michael Phillip, Corey, people on MindPod Network, I know in my heart of hearts, I'm not competing against these people. We have joined together for a much more noble cause than that. So it's easy for me to dismiss it. Now, when I have in the past worked with people who are actively competing with you, who are actively trying to stab you in the back. So you have to have this, it's guarding against putting away the ego because the ego can tip you off things. And I think intuition is also involved with the ego. It's not like they're totally separate functions. Your intuition can be the thing that launches your ego to like, you know, the guard dog to be like, hey, is something going on? And like, there have been plenty of times in my life where maybe the ego isn't the primary function, but something, it gets involved because something is like, this isn't right. Like I remember specifically in two situations, some guy was getting me to go, wanted me to go work for his company in San Francisco. And it seemed fucking perfect. Super high salary, plugged into the type of work I wanted to be doing, you know, seemed like good people, seemed like doing important shit. But there was something each time I was like, no, there's something I'm not getting here. There's something. And that was my intuition. But then my ego, in a beneficial way, was like, you know, you need to be a little protected here. You know, there's there's nothing weird, but you need to be a little protected here. Why don't you just wait and see what happens? That is an example of intuition and ego working together in a beneficial way. Because I can tell you this, if I would have taken that job, because one of my friends did take that job, he ended his job there by being chased down the street from someone high on cocaine with a knife. So, you know what I mean? Like that literally is how that situation ended. And he was gung-ho about it. So there is a way to kind of honor that the ego exists. It's like this. It's like there's the One You Feed podcast. You know, he asked this parable about which wolf are you going to feed, the good or the bad wolf? And Sharon Salzberg had the best answer I've ever heard, which is, I want to feed both of them, but I want to be nice, especially nice and compassionate to the bad wolf, because the bad wolf needs compassion. So when we when we shit on the ego nonstop, how do you think the ego feels? We already know this is a structure that doesn't react well to any challenges. It's super defensive. It's like a little kid. You poke it and it freaks out. So like when we're talking consciously about how the ego is so shitty, we got to get around it, we don't want to do it, like, yeah, we know there's things that aren't great about it, right? We know, like, if your dog is a new puppy and it's pissing on the floor, that's not a good thing. But you're not just going to scream at it for days on end being like, fuck you, I don't need you, why are you fucking doing this? You're going to slowly kind of get familiar with it, be compassionate to it, and get to know, like, how do we work together here? How do we work in tandem? Yeah.
And something, too, you mentioned earlier, it was that that I think is, I go back and forth on this podcast between defending religion and, you know, poking at the bullshit of what I don't like about it. But in defense of religion here is that that community that a lot of religious communities foster is based on basically we've theoretically everybody who's at a given church, we have agreed at some level we're going to keep our egos in check. You're trying to surround yourself with people who, even if we can't completely prevent our egos, and we're not trying to necessarily completely destroy them, we can at least say, I know everybody in this room with me, at least we can agree, like, okay, yes, there's a purpose to put my ego aside for this. And that's what lets me not notice my ego and also put it in its proper place too. It's that element of building trust, because that's something I encountered. You encounter a lot in LA in the entertainment industry, God knows.
Because when
you do have to be, your ego has to be more protective when you are around other people who are fine with letting their ego completely run the show of their lives, which is a lot of people.
It's everywhere, though. It's everywhere.
It is everywhere.
I have friends in LA. I know I was there. I can feel the vibes of that city. It's bizarre, you know, why so many people are there for so many different reasons that probably aren't going to be fulfilling for them. But it's everywhere. When I made the decision to, you know, primarily work with nonprofits and spiritual organizations, my assumption is that there will be far less ego involved. You know, there'll be far less consternation, you know, infighting, all this stuff. Wrong. Super fucking wrong. That's not how it works. It's everywhere. If anything in the spiritual sector, if you have been doing a spiritual bypass for decades, you're done. You're fucking done. You're not pulling out of that fucking nosedive. Like, that's it. Your operating system now is spiritual bypass, which means, essentially, for those not familiar with that term, you will justify any action you do using some spiritual ideology or concept. So if you fuck someone over, well, that's just their karma. You did some shitty thing. Well, that's what was warranted for because you were following a higher calling. So it even gets even more tricky when you start dealing with these esoteric concepts, or like you're on a mission or you're doing the Lord's work or whatever, which is why we see something like organized religion. It's so easily co-opted. And what you're talking about, you know, forming these kind of trust communities and tribal leadership, tribes, right? Whether it's a church or somewhere else, the danger inherent to those types of organizations is all it takes is one person to subvert that entire fucking system.
Absolutely.
They can say, you know what? I see all these weak people giving up their control and their ability and their power. I'm going to come in and I'm going to fucking, you know, tell them the way it is and, you know, tweak this here and manipulate this here.
Yep.
And most of the time, that is not a conscious decision. And we love to ascribe conscious decision to actions. It's one of our favorite things to do. It's so easy to look at someone like Donald Trump and be like, this guy is just a vindictive piece of shit who is hell-bent on causing suffering. I guarantee you he is not thinking like that. I guarantee. Now, he's doing that shit, don't get me wrong, but he has some elaborate justification model in his head that allows him to function like that. No one, unless you're just a complete sociopath and like a serial killer, is walking around thinking that they purposely want to hurt and do bad things to other people. That's just not how we're built as humans. Nevertheless, whether it's from childhood trauma, whether it's your karma, whether it's situations in life that has shaped you, people carry around a lot of trauma with them, and they typically put that back into the world because that's what they've been taught. By not dealing with these serious injuries that we have, which has been a big part of what I've been learning, especially over the past year and a half, is like, you gotta work on your own shit big time. That's your life's mission, is to work on your own shit. If you get to a point where you feel like you have your shit kind of worked out, then start moving on to the next step and maybe start trying to help other people. But you can't escape yourself. You know what I mean? There's no method I've found. It's not meditation. It's not anything. It's you are there, you know, for now, and you got to deal with it.
And it's so, I love that. I agree that I think it's so important. We don't give people enough benefit of the doubt in a lot of these cases, and that people are, I think I agree with you that most vast majority of people are, in their head, they're doing the right thing. And it's so easy to get caught up in it, especially when your emotion takes over. Like, even yesterday, this is like a thing that I was just in traffic. I was trying to do like a maneuver that basically I almost got in a wreck, and it would have been the other guy's fault, but he was so angry at me And normally I've been, you know, we've all been caught up in that situation. I'm mad at him too for, you know, I was steaming at him for like a good 30 seconds, a minute. But then I like, and we kind of kept following each other for a little bit. So I had to like keep thinking about him for a while. Like we weren't intentionally following each other. We were just going on the same road. And then I was like thinking like, you know what? In his head, he thinks he's justified. He thinks that I'm the wrong one. And isn't that kind of funny, like how much we're so caught up in like this, like, oh, fuck it. Like, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in that. And there, I am caught up in that in minor ways every day of my life.
Oh, I mean,
every hour of my life, basically.
Minor and major for me. I mean, anger. Someone said something to me, which I've been repeating a lot because I think it's valid and I hadn't really thought about it, is when I get anger is my number one mental affliction that's not helpful for me. I get anything can set me off. Two days ago, you know, I was yelling at Alexis because she finished the coffee that I liked and didn't get me and went out and got the coffee that she liked. And it was, like, ridiculous. Like, the stupidest thing ever. There's no way to justify that looking back and be like, well, she should have. No, you're an asshole. Why are you doing that? So, but one thing that was pointed out to me that I think is very valid is that if your normal procedure is to get angry at everything that triggers you or gets upset, you're often overlooking an entire spectrum of emotions that also could be there. So, like, sometimes I'm sad. Sometimes I'm hurt. Sometimes I'm scared. But my natural reaction is just to bypass any of those other emotions, just be like, I'm angry. Fuck this. Fuck you. Fuck this. Fuck that. And that's just not an effective use of anger. And one of the things I try to remember, because, you know, we like to be Satan, you know, negative emotions. In Tibetan Buddhism, every negative emotion or poison, as they call them, actually, if you keep smoothing it away, has a root essence that is beneficial to you. So for anger, it's clarity. Sometimes when we get really angry, not all the time, sometimes it's a cloud and it's a haze, but sometimes we get so angry, we see incredibly clearly. So if you can kind of brush away and scrub off all this bullshit that happens and start diving down into what is making you angry, you can really get a tremendous amount of insight. The goal of this to me is A, to be aware that this shit is happening, because, you know, for 25, 30 years of my life, like, I don't even know if I would have copped to having an anger issue, even though there's so much evidence that it had been going on in my life. But once you start kind of being aware of it, then you slowly start to gather resources or tactics or tools for how to deal with it. And when I'm saying anger here, this could be anything for anyone. This could be depression. This could be sadness. This could be loneliness. Yep, you know, these are things that are negative in the sense that they're uncomfortable for us and people around us, but they're also opportunities for us to be like, what the fuck is going on? What the fuck is going on? Like, how do we fix this? How do we make that? If you know you don't want to be screaming at a guy in traffic or, you know, festering about, you know, something that he did or like vice versa, how do you stop it? What are techniques that we can use? What are some practical things we can do to get to the bottom of this? And also be patient with ourselves, recognizing it's not going to be a light switch.
Totally. And like, you know, anger is the quote unquote anger problem is that's the classic one. But I think something you just kind of keyed in for me in my own life, I think I've had, I mean, and I've got had through stretches of depression before and stretches where I think I had cut to sadness almost as a default reaction, which is also you're also bypassing things like anger. Sometimes I needed to be a little bit more angry.
That's right.
And there was,
yeah, there's a spectrum of emotions. And I think especially for guys in Western culture, we are really like, and I don't, you know, I don't get too much into the gender stuff, but I mean, it is very obvious to me that guys growing up in this culture are really not taught how to deal with their emotions at all. And you don't realize it until you're an adult. Like, you just don't realize it. It just seems like the way that things are, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. And yes, there's obviously differences in how we process the world, but I don't know a ton of guys, and I know a lot of open and authentic people, but I don't know a ton of guys who are confident crying in public. I don't know a ton of people who are even open about talking about the last time they cried or something. And it's
unless it's with a sports victory, then it's okay to cry in public.
Dude, I mean, speaking of, well, when the Dolphins won the division title in 2008, I'm a huge Miami Dolphins fan. We were 1-15 the year before, and we went 11-5 and kept the Patriots and the Jets out of the playoffs. It was truly the happiest point of my life as a Dolphins fan. I was at a bar in Bethesda back in Maryland where I'm from, and I was with my friends, and there was a friend who I'm good friends with now but didn't know that well, and I was crying. You know, it was tears of joy. It was ecstasy. I was like, I couldn't imagine how happy I was. And he's like, dude, that's some next level shit. I mean, that's some next level shit. And I was like, you're right. But if it's in the context of sports or something that isn't relevant or personal to our lives, it's much easier to do that. Yeah, man, it can be anything. It can be depression. It can be anger. But if we have this kind of protocol that we go through when something happens to us, it's hard sometimes to A, be aware that it's happening, and B, especially to break out of it. That said, one of the easiest things I've found, and doesn't require anything special, not to go get microdose or something like that, is just having conversations about this shit. That's why I think podcasting is really a valuable resource. And I don't like to get too, you know, highfalutin about podcasts, but I do think my biggest advances and growth have come from just having conversations with people and talking about the shit and getting it out in the open and getting some of this internal stuff into external reality. It's transformative. Like, it really is. And it doesn't solve everything. It's not like the only thing you need to do, but you know, God knows how many people will be listening to this and be like, oh yeah, like my normal operating procedure is I get really angry, or I get really sad, or I get really hurt, or I do this. That's it. That's the first moment of awareness that it could be happening. And then you're like, oh shit, now I have the next part of my life to deal with this.
Yeah. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think to kind of wrap it up and put it in a little bit of a bow, bridge building is really important to me too. And I think one of the goals I had with this podcast originally, I don't know how successful I've been with it, is bridging a bit of the gap between people who are identified as atheist and agnostic and people who are religious too, realizing we can have conversations together about the same stuff, and we realize we actually do have a lot of common values there. And I think conversations is, if you're interested in bridge building, I think conversations are at least the base unit of bridge building in terms of human to human connections.
It has to be.
So I guess that's we'll just put a bow on it right there. But
sure, man.
So thank you so much for coming on. This was great. I would would love to have you back on some other time in the future to keep going, because I could have gone for a long time, but I have relative truths to deal with.
The responsibilities of the world still exist. Yeah. I know that. Yeah, man. I had a blast. Thank you for having me on. And yeah, man. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you. And that's the show. Once again, thank you so much to Noah. Go to mindpodnetwork.com for all his network's great podcasts. Check out Synchronicity, the podcast, and chooseyourownreligion.com for more of this show. Love you guys. Namaste.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?